The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So it probably doesn't need to be said, but one of the core practices or the core practices that we do here at IMC is mindfulness. And mindfulness is, you know, is both a specific kind of practice, but also is often talked about in a very broad way to include a whole approach to living a life. And what I'd like to emphasize today is that mindfulness, the quality and the strength of our mindfulness is directly related to how we live our lives. And that and there's a paradox, and that is that as the mindfulness gets stronger, we become, it really becomes obvious that the mindfulness decreases when we are unethical, decreases when we do things that knowingly cause harm to others. And that conversely, that mindfulness is supported by the by living ethically, by living a life that's supportive of other people and beneficial to other people. And this, there's a very intimate relationship between ethics and mindfulness. It's they're mutually supportive of each other. And the Buddha emphasized one area of our life that is easily overlooked and frequently overlooked as an area to be concerned about our ethics, how we are, how we live, and that has to do with speech. For a variety of reasons, we get pulled into the world of speech, so often it's often one of the most difficult places to be mindful in as we speak. And maybe because of that, it's difficult to attend to, be careful for, the impact we have on our speech and the motivations behind our speaking. But our speech is some of the biggest impact on the world around us. One of the motivations to talk about this today is that it seems we've come to a point in our society where the great conflicts of our society are not being fought out in the battlefields, but rather in the verbal world of how people talk. And so, you know, in the press and on the news and in books and how people speak with each other. And the degree of divisiveness that has arisen in our society at this point has made it almost impossible for some people to speak to each other. And there are people who come together for family gatherings and they won't talk to each other because of this tremendous divide between what their views are, how they understand things, and how they speak to each other about it. And there are people now who are saying that the biggest challenge of our society, the biggest divide, it has to do with this issue of divisiveness, political divisiveness that goes on and how people are not talking to each other. And it's eclipsed or become stronger than some of the other great conflicts and divisions in our society, racism and class and gender and sexuality and all kinds of things. And, I think that, one little representation of this is that generally, our insight scene in the West is relatively liberal, not entirely so. But I've had people tell me who are not liberal, I remember once teaching a retreat, and there was a man who said told me privately he was the philosopher for the Tea Party many years ago. And he was a lovely man. And I met him as a teacher, and he seemed to have a lot of integrity and goodness in him, and he seemed smart and reasonable in many ways. And he said to me privately, I can't come out in this community. the degree of animosity that I'll receive makes it impossible to stay here. And so that's quite a powerful statement. Recent surveys, I don't know how much we can trust the surveys, right? But still, one recent survey has pointed out that Democrats and liberals are more likely to cut off people from conversation, from relationships, than Republicans and conservatives. They both do it, but Democrats, it's a greater, much greater degree. And to the degree to which, probably safe to say a majority of us tend to be liberals, this is something we need to look at in ourselves quite seriously, not just kind of keep it out there, it's them. And so the degree of vilification that goes on, and the degree of divisiveness, and the degree of separation of people has gotten to be quite strong, and we need to look at it. So the Buddha had clear guidelines or discussions about speech, and he used the language of skillful and unskillful to talk about four kinds of unskillful speech and four kinds of skillful speech. And the unskillful speech, the word skillful is an interesting word. In and of itself is not necessarily an ethical word. However, if you look through the language of the ancient Buddhist texts, it's probably the way it plays out, this word kusala, and what are the implications of it, are probably closer to our word of ethics than almost any other Buddhist word. And the reason for that is that kusala is directly connected to what causes harm and what causes benefit. And so akusala, unskillful, is that which causes harm, and skillful is that which brings benefit. And what's interesting in the teachings of the Buddha is that you cannot cause harm to others without causing harm to yourself. The intentional causing of harm to other people, and whether it's through speech, and vilification and anger and these kinds of things that are kind of pushing people away or creating divisions in our society, that you can't do that kind of thing without it harming oneself as well. And then if you kind of follow the Buddha's logic, he says this, that if you harm yourself, you're also harming our society around us. And so the alternative is to do skillful things, those things which are beneficial. And if you benefit yourself, the understanding in ancient Buddhism is that you will benefit others. And if you benefit others, that's a benefit for yourself. And these are mutually related, closely related phenomena. So he talked about four kinds of unskillful speech. And these are so these are false speech, divisive speech, abusive speech, and pointless speech. And pointless, I think, is kind of a... No one really quite knows how to translate this word from Pali. But pointless, I think, kind of maybe is the best, one of the best representations. And when the Buddha gave illustrations for false speech, he used kind of a dramatic example, and that is when you're asked to bear witness, and one translator says in court, but in meetings, in town hall meetings back then, they didn't have courts, or in family or different situations, bear witness of what was true or false, what happened and didn't happen. To speak falsely there as a witness for one's own personal gain or for the gain of someone else, that is unskillful. So there's many kinds of falsehoods people can make. But, one that has a big impact is if we bear witness falsely when someone's being judged or someone's being considered their behavior. And this idea of falsehood and truth now has become a hot topic in our society. It's kind of amazing that, the amount of doubt, it's almost like the postmodernist philosophy has puts a lot of doubt about how we interpret and how subjective our understanding is, has gotten into a degree of the public discourse that we can't agree on anything. And Recently, the lawyer for the president said, truth is not truth, this weekend. I mean, that's kind of an interesting statement. And so you know, it speaks to something very dramatic going on in our society. And how do we follow the, you know, this idea of speaking truthfully or avoiding false speech when the whole question of what is truth is so dramatically questioned these days? So the second kind of unskillful speech, and the one that kind of inspired this talk, is that of divisive speech, and the speech which divides people, and separates those who are united. It's the language of the Buddhism. Divides those who are already united, and continues to separate the people who are separated. And I found, you know, early in my mindfulness practice, a very interesting thing to pay attention to, and that is when I spoke, the words that I spoke, even if they were ethical, when you know, there's nothing unethical necessarily about them, I became sensitive to the impact that my speech has, and I could feel that if I said certain things, it would create a little more distance, or people would pull back, or the energy would go away, or things would shut down a little bit. And if I said spoke other ways, maybe the same topic, but just a different approach of talking about it, there'd be a stronger connection, a stronger sense of participation in the conversation, or a little more energy there and engagement in it. And I found this that simple kind of tuning in, what's going on in the conversation, if people engaged, they're not engaged, what I'm saying, how is it being received, was a huge piece of information that was interesting. And if we look at this you know, in terms of ethics, in terms of harm, you know, we see the huge degrees in which people in our society now are speaking in ways that makes communication or makes the divide almost insurmountable between them. This kind of speech, the Buddha said, this divisive speech, is one that creates factions, creates groups that are opposed to each other. And maybe that's one of the reasons why people love doing this kind of language, because it creates a very strong sense of us, me. It's a kind of a conceit. There are group conceits, a groupism, like egoism, groupistic, as opposed to egotistic, that, you know, there's really a sense that I'm special, we're the chosen ones, we're the ones who know what's right. And a lot of the energy around speaking angrily and complaining about other people is a powerful way in which people bond and feel connected to each other. And that's probably part of the reason that's fueling this. You know, we're the ones who know, or something. So to speak in such a way that we don't exasperate the factionism, the divisiveness of society. The third kind of unskillful speech is abusive speech. So sometimes it's translated as harsh speech, but I think it's more closer to abusive and offensive what it is. The Buddha described it as cutting speech, hurtful speech, offensive speech, connected with anger. So that all makes sense to some degree. But then he has one more little definition of what, or description of what abusive speech is, kind of how it functions or something. And then he says, it's unproductive for concentration. You know, what? Well, you know, suddenly he changes the topic. You know, what is this? Well, you know, it's no longer ethics now. Or, you know, why is it bringing in concentration? And why is that important? In this kind of practice tradition of Buddhism, concentration gives access to some of the most important sense of well-being, of wisdom, of understanding that a person can tap into. And people who don't have access to concentration states can have no idea why this is so useful and so important. But for someone like the Buddha who did tap into them, then it's really clear it diminishes us for our kind of our harm, or kind of we get contracted, or we lose touch with something very precious when we lose touch with our concentration states. You know, even to tap in a little bit to getting a little bit concentrated, a little bit calm, a little more settled, unified for a daily sitting, changes the context, changes the orientation we have for our life. It changes what we're inclined to say or do coming out of that state. If we're frazzled and harried and running around being busy, it's so much easier to do things which are harmful to others. Coming out of a calm, settled place, it's easier to see that we don't want to do that, and we're less inclined to do that. And as one of the themes of this talk, if we do that, it harms us. If we're settled and have peaceful and have a sense of well-being and openness, and suddenly we lash out in anger at someone, you can kind of feel how that's lost. But if you're always angry, you know, a little bit more anger is kind of good because it, you know, gets you energized and gets you kind of feeling like you're right and gets you feel like you're, you know, it's, you know, has its, you know, just more of the same in a good way. But if you have a real qualitative experience of the absence of anger, absence of ill will, that comes with concentration, it changes the whole game of reference point for how we live our life. So abusive speech is unproductive for concentration. So people who know about concentration and its value, will try to avoid that kind of speech. And then there's a pointless speech. And so exactly what word English should be used for this. Sometimes it's called idle speech in some translations. So, you know, you can decide, yeah, maybe, but I'll read you the Buddha's description of it. Speaking at the wrong time and about what is not real. Speech that is useless, contrary to the Dharma, worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. Is that pointless? Is that a good translation? Or, you know, maybe unbeneficial, since that's one of the words that describes it. It's also another possibility. And this includes, to speech which is not real, it's different than speaking what's false. What's not real, and kind of a different category. Exactly what it means, I can't, you know, in the ancient language, I can't tell. But certainly how I feel about it, it includes exaggeration, pointless commentary, and telling tales as if they were real. And so, why do we speak what we do? What motivates us? And is it really real what we're talking about? Or is it the difference between interpretation and real is a really important thing. And the difference between opinion and what's real is a hugely important thing. And that's very hard to see for people. People are strongly identified with their opinions. My opinions are mine, so therefore there's kind of almost a, for many people, a benefit of doubt that we have that there must be true. I'm thinking it must be true. It's quite easy, I think, for many of us to see that other people, what they say is false, absurd, unuseful, harmful, and all that. I see it out there, but to see it in oneself, especially the strong identification with the, you know, who we are and our value has a lot to do with our opinion. It's hard to see that we're talking about something which is maybe has a place, has value, but is it real? And if it's not exactly real, but maybe it's not false either, do we hold more lightly? Do we hold it in such a way that it doesn't contribute to more divisiveness? Can we hold it in a way that even talk about our opinions in a way that welcomes people into our conversation or allows for other perspectives as opposed to this is how it is. So then, to speak in skillful ways, the opposite of these four unskillful forms of speech, is speech which is mutually beneficial. And I feel like I can't emphasize that enough, the idea that this idea of mutual benefit. There's a strong tendency to people to measure, evaluate things as good for me. Some people do the opposite, it's good for others. But the idea that actually they work together is a very profound principle. And if you really want to benefit yourself, you want the benefit for society as a whole. You want to benefit other people around you. If they're happy, it's easier for you to be happy. It's easier for you to get support and all kinds of things. So, and then this wonderful way in which mindfulness and skillfulness go together. If we give attention to skillful speech, the more we give attention to skillful speech, the more mindfulness grows. And that's partly because attention is mindfulness. So the more we bring our attention to it, the more it grows. The more we speak skillfully, ethically, the more mindfulness grows. And the more mindfulness grows, the greater is our sensitivity to the ethical impact of our speech. And so part of what mindfulness does is not just simply kind of being in the control tower, watching what goes on. It's developing capacity to really feel the full range of how we experience life and process life. And that includes an ethical sensitivity, become sensitive to the impact we have and what goes on. So as that mindfulness grows, we will be more interested in skillful speech. It's just a natural byproduct. So there are the four opposites to the unskillful speech, which are the four forms of skillful speech. So these are speaking what's true, speaking what creates concord, speaking what is inoffensive, and speaking what is beneficial. And as a set, these four, the Buddha describes them as four kinds of speech, or four kinds of living by the Dharma, and four kinds of living in harmony. And I kind of find these interesting, these ideas. So living in accordance with the Dharma. I think of here, I'd like to just, maybe it's my interpretation, but I like to think of the Dharma as something that's deeply personal. It's really something that flows from inside of us. That's so deeply personal that it's almost impersonal. You can't identify with it, but it kind of flows out of us, a certain kind of goodness and engagement with what is beneficial, avoiding what's harmful. And that living in a way that's harmonious has to do with how we live our social life together. And so these two are very important. But this living, how we live our social life, can flow out of the Dharma, can flow out of this deep wellspring inside of goodness and wisdom that can be here. And so it flows from us how it flows into the world, and helping to create harmony. So speaking what is true is mindfulness out loud. I think, mindfulness is to recognize in a certain way what's really happening here, and to, and we don't necessarily want to say everything that's possibly true. Truth can be a weapon. Truth can be used in abusive ways. Truth can be used in ways that is not conducive to harmony and to society and everything. So we want to be a little bit sensitive to that. But there is one area of truth-telling which is kind of like absolute in Buddhism. And there's few, maybe there's not that many real absolutes in Buddhism, but I think this is one that, the Buddha didn't say this, but I think it really is implied out of the whole Buddhist principles of life. And that absolute statement is, it's never okay to lie to yourself. And, so maybe few people think they lie to themselves, but it's never okay to do that. And that's the one thing. So whether you speak the truth out loud is one thing, but don't speak it to yourself. Certainly try to speak it to yourself. Don't sidestep it or ignore it. And when we speak the truth wisely and inoffensively, we are harnessing the power of mindfulness. And speaking the truth also contributes to trust and safety. It's a wonderful thing to be with people we can trust, because we can trust what they say. We might not agree with them, but we feel like they're going to be honest with us. It's a beautiful thing. So the second kind of skillful communication is speaking to create concord. And the Buddha describes this as speech that reconciles those who are divided. I just love this idea. Reconciles those who are divided. So even the people who, you know, maybe you're not divided from people, but maybe people in your family are divided from each other, or friends. And so speaking away, can you reconcile them? And one way is to be very careful how you speak about people who are not present, non-present third-party people. And are you speaking about them in a way that's going to make it a little bit disparaging of them, or a little bit critical of them, so that when the person you're speaking to, when they see that person, it's going to create a little ripple, or big ripple, in that relationship? Or do you speak in ways that are truthful and appropriate, but makes the person you're talking to feel good about that person, can't wait to see them, or, you know, delighted to see the person and happy to see them because they see them in a good light? You know, not everyone's always, you know, 100% good, but if we emphasize what is not good, it kind of feeds it or reinforces it or creates division. But if we're not to ignore what's difficult and challenging, but if we clearly see and acknowledge what's good, then that maybe can begin traveling and supporting and grow in our society. So reconcile those who are divided and supports those who are united. And then the Buddha described this as words of someone who loves concord, delights in concord, enjoys concord, and speak things that create concord. So I love this little expression, loves and enjoys and delights in concord. I'm delighted by the very idea of it. And the Dharma is here to bring joy and happiness, and part of that joy and happiness we can feel comes from our delight in being skillful, delight in being ethical. I used to be surprised when I first got into Buddhism that there was this idea that people could feel joy in their ethics, in their good ethics, their skillfulness. And I thought, what? That was like a foreign idea. And then what happened to me is, as I got concentrated and my mindfulness grew, that became obvious. That the inner sense of purity or goodness that can develop in these deeper states of meditation really spoke to this delight and joy that being ethical has. Because being ethical is not like you have to follow rules, but rather it's to be attuned to something that's really good within, really healthy. So then there's a fourth kind of skillful speech, is inoffensive speech. And this the Buddha describes as soothing to the ear, affectionate, and then it has a wonderful expression, going to the heart, and touching the heart, maybe. But literally, it's going to the heart. Polite, appealing and pleasing to many people. And then he had one more little expression for what inoffensive speech is. And that is speech that people treasure. They want to, you know, the treasure means that apparently you want to keep it. One translator, this is literally the word treasure, but one translator translated it as what people want to record. And then the last form of speech, skillful speech, is what can be called beneficial speech. And these are timely, about what is real, beneficial, and concerned with both the Dharma life and an ethical life. Furthermore, it is spoken with clear explanations, delineations, and benefits. So pointless speech sometimes might be important things we're trying to say, but we talk in such vague or convoluted ways that it was pointless to have said it. So you need to be careful with our speech and be clear what we're saying. So it's clear that in the Buddha's teaching at least, in the idea of avoiding unskillful speech and engaging in skillful speech, that he has a strong emphasis on speaking in ways that are beneficial to others. Our speech, as well as ways we communicate, are born in ourselves, and from there flows into our interpersonal lives. The close connection with what is personal inside of us and the relationship we have with others means that if we want to care well for both these areas, if we only care well for one of these areas, we should care for both. To be happy in ourselves, we can promote unity and affection in our relationships. To promote unity and affection in our relationships, we can cultivate the conditions for happiness in ourselves. It's very tempting to respond to anger with anger, divisiveness with further division, disdain with disparagement. And doing so may, if I can just put this in quotation marks, doing so might work in the short term, but not it doesn't really work in the long term. And it works in very limited ways. It certainly doesn't promote personal and interpersonal peace. That is the goal of Buddhist practice. One can't clean a stain with more of the stain. So we need something else to clean a stain. A stain in our social life and political life is only cleaned by our capacity for goodness, generosity, and cooperation, perhaps fueled by resolute fervor. So to really be motivated strongly. This is not an idea that is always supported, that you should not meet anger with anger. Even in the time of the Buddha, there were people who would argue, you have to attack the people who are attacking you verbally. You have to be angry, otherwise you're weak. And there's no. And so there's one response that was to this that was given in verse in poetry. One makes things worse who returns anger with anger. Not returning anger with anger, one wins a battle hard to win. When another is angry, one wins welfare for oneself. And for the other, if one mindfully keeps one's peace. People who think one is a fool, if one heals one's own anger and that of the other, have no skill in the Dharma. Maybe that wasn't so clear, but so you win two times over if you don't respond with anger to anger, and the two times you win is you win for yourself and you help the other person win. That's kind of an interesting idea. And if you think that healing one's own anger and healing the anger of the other is a foolish thing to do, then one has no skill in the Dharma. So finally, with mindfulness, part of the value of developing mindfulness, the motivation to employ skillful speech is not derived from moral injunction. Rather, mindfulness reveals the personal inner consequences of both unskillful and skillful speech. It shows us that it is for our own personal benefit to speak in skillful ways. That is, in ways that benefit both self and others. So that's my politically commentary for the day. And so do you have any comments, questions, statements you want to make? So if there's a mic, is there still a mic on the stage there? Maybe if you can pass it over.
Hello? Okay. A question on the maybe relative importance of the skillful right speech. If you're in a situation, I can give maybe a couple examples. If you're in a situation where no matter how well packaged a truth may seem or may be delivered, you know you're going to create divisiveness, what should you do? And similarly, if you're always after concord, and it's almost like you're trying to keep everything together and you never let maybe the conflicts that are needed to happen, is that also beneficial?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I think that one of the shadow sides or kind of difficulties that Buddhist communities sometimes have is being conflict aversive. And so emphasizing concord to such a degree that they're willing to kind of ignore, or overlook, or not really address some important issues that are going on. And so so how do we address issues where it might create divisions or separation or something? And one of that is if it's very clear that what needs to be talked about needs to be talked about, one has done one's own homework to have clarified that I can speak now without anger, without aversion, without wanting to cause harm. I've really kind of thought about how I'm going to speak about this that is supportive for the situation, is not putting anyone down or threatening anyone, but clearly laying it out so that if they want, they can participate. We need to talk about this. And I knowing the people involved, I don't think it's going to work. But we still need to do it. And it's their responsibility, it's their karma, and we're going to have to work with the divisions that are formed. But we can't go forward not talking about it. And so sometimes we have to allow that to happen and work with it. And sometimes it's very unfortunate. And sometimes, it does create insurmountable division, not because we're doing it. It has to do with how the person receives it and takes it on. We can't control that completely. But we do our best, and we know people well and know how they react. We might try to do our homework, think about ahead of time. How do I approach them this time? Is it timely? Is this the right time? Maybe I really need to wait a few days until they're in a better space or until there's a little opening. Maybe I need to wait until I'm feel a little more kinder to the person. I just feel so hurt right now that I just know that I'm easily triggered into saying things that are not going to be helpful. So let me wait until I feel, not so hurt and have processed it. So there's all this homework we can do, but we can't, there's no guarantee that that's going to work. And sometimes we have to let it play out. Otherwise, it's worse. Is that kind of what you're asking, or? Yeah, please.
Hi, Gil. It's nice to meet you.
Can you hold it closer? Or?
Hi, yeah. Gil. It's nice to meet you.
Mark? Yeah, because my ears are not so good.
Oh. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Is this good? What happens, like so many of us, if this lifetime is just very, very challenging, and you're going through a lot of suffering physically, mentally, emotionally, you know, kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
And you're trying as hard as you can to, like, I've been meditating for over 40 years and studying originally with Pema Chodron, and just so many wise, wise people listening to you. I'm so grateful I could hear you from Florida and audio, and Tara Brock, so many wise people that have helped so much. And what happens in the people who you are the closest to, friends, family, and all, when you're in your own heart, you're knowing you're being as truthful as you can, but it's like you're not believed. And as many times as you say it, like I've spent so much time trying to prepare what I'll say to have it come out so maybe it would really be heard. But if people maybe just not ready to hear it or don't, well, selective listening sometimes I think people, or just it never seems to come out that way. So what do you do from there? You feel you have to be honest, and but that it's so painful when you're not believed.
Yeah.
Even starting from when you were a little, yeah. You know, when very crazy things happened. And
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. And I think a good place to begin is appreciating that you have this interest and this concern. That speaks well for you. It's fantastic that you're wanting to address this and interested in this topic. And I wish more people had that. And
I feel like I have to, survival and this world's survival.
Yeah, so we can start by appreciating what you're bringing here. And then, and families are difficult, society is difficult. And so one of the kind of guidelines that Buddha gives for speaking is only speak when it's beneficial, when it works, and when it has some benefit. And sometimes it just, there's no ability to have a conversation with some people. They shut down, they get angry, and there's no way to talk about some things. And even though we're talking about the truth, there's no point. It's pointless to talk about the truth if nothing changes, or if it even gets worse. So some people learn to hold their mouth. Some people learn to surf around issues, or to choose when they're with even family members. They're very careful. You know, very careful about. You know, they can't just kind of freely go over or have. You know, it's a relationship that's fraught with danger. And so, well, you know, we can meet, you know, at Denny's for lunch once a week, you know. That seems to be a safe place to go.
Do you think ever it could be like a karmic thing? You know, sometimes people were around the most, and do you think it could possibly be karmically from another life, things we deliberately brought in to work out or try to? And
It definitely could be karma. But I think that in terms of our society and where it's most productive to look at this is to look at something called family systems dynamics, family system therapy. And this is a form of therapy that looks at the family dynamics that goes back multiple lives, goes back not, you know, lifetimes, but goes back over the generations, and how some of these deep, deeply ingrained patterns that people live in and they seem to have a wonderful ability to replicate for themselves is because of the family system constellation which they kind of have gotten used to and their position in it. And so some people actually, not intending to do it, but because they're familiar with the family system they grew up with, will kind of gravitate to the same one over and over again, and the one maybe that their parents had and whatever. So, you know, I think it's a wonderful form of therapy and very helpful to understand how family systems work. And perhaps, you know, some of the larger issues of our society are unfortunately playing out some people's family systems dynamic. You know, they're trying to please one's father. It seems to be one that is, you know, currently happening in full view for everyone and being passed on from one generation to the next.
The psychic buck ends here when you become aware of it and you try not to, have everything that your mother and father have said come out of your mouth unconsciously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in terms of, you know, our practice here, mindfulness, my understanding it in family systems therapy, one of the axioms, central tenets, is that if one member of the family practices non-reactive awareness, the whole family system moves towards health. So, you know, non-reactive awareness is kind of like what we do. So this is not easy stuff, and to give a talk about, you know, skillful speech, these kind of guidelines the Buddha has for it, you know, it's relatively easy for me to come up here and speak, right? You know, it's like, this is how it is, right? It's not easy to apply them in our relationships. It takes skill, it takes thought, it takes wisdom, it takes, you know, it's something we develop and learn over time. It's not either or. And our interpersonal relationships are constantly changing and shifting, and each one requires different kinds of thought, different kinds of consideration, a reflection about how these guidelines might work and how to do them best. But the North Star that leads us is to create a society, communities, families, friendships, that where people live in concord, that people feel united rather than separated. And I think that's the direction of the Dharma. So let's get to work. Thank you.